time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for October 24th, 2020. So yesterday it was 80 degrees here in Cleveland, and today it's 50. I guess that old saw, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute, holds true here in Cleveland. But there is one bright spot, and that's our show. Politics has certainly been up for many, if not most of us lately, but I'm not certain I saw the juxtaposition of bicycle advocacy and politics until my conversation with Peter Wilborn, the founder and partner at Bike Law. He always makes me broaden my thinking, and today is no different. This is a conversation you do not want to miss. Then after a break, we'll head to Knoxville, Tennessee to speak with Professor Chris Cherry. If you've ever come to a railroad crossing and missed the mark, meaning you hit the crossing at an angle that caused you to crash, you're going to appreciate the work my second guest has done to mitigate that problem. And then we'll do a quick check-in with Bike Cleveland's executive director, Jacob Van Sickle. As every other organization has had to do in the past 7 months, Bike Cleveland needed to make radical changes to its programs and events in the wake of COVID-19. Jacob is going to fill us in on those changes, as well as offering us some bright spots to focus on for 2021. So how is politics impacting cycling? Is there undue influence to how we perceive our cycling movement from the outside or even from the inside? What do equity and inclusiveness really look like? And why is infrastructure, bicycle infrastructure, so important to the overall success of cycling? And even of more urgency is the understanding of why it is important to embrace law enforcement as a relationship that will benefit us as cyclists instead of distancing ourselves from it. Here's my conversation with Peter Wilborn. Hello, Peter. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How are you?
Great, Diane. So great to talk to you again.
It is. We really need to catch up. And it's been a while. I've talked to Rachel several times, but I haven't had a chance to really sit down with you. And so I hope you're sitting down and we can have this conversation.
Absolutely. I'm sitting down. What do you got for me?
I wanted to discuss a topic you're interested in right now, and it's sort of upfront for all of us, and that's bicycle advocacy and politics. I don't think a lot of people put those two in the same sentence. So tell me about that.
Diane, it's what I am confronted with most often. It's what I'm most disappointed by. It's what I am struggling to come to terms with. It's that the politics that are dividing our country, maybe irreparably, have impacted the cycling community in almost every level, in every forum, from group rides to social media to advocacy groups to policy concerns. The politics of the United States are just front and center in the bike community.
And how do you see that manifesting itself?
Well, if you think about the cycling community, it's such a big tent. I mean, it truly is. People who are outside of the cycling community kind of see us all as similar, but the reality is we're very, very different. And the community has always been inclusive and always been much more diverse, at least politically diverse. It attracted independent thinkers, cycling has, you know, in the 70s for sure. And I think right now what we're seeing is ultra-right wing and ultra-left wing, and the middle is being drowned out in the conversation. And I think it is really impacted the conversation about everything involving cycling.
Give me an example of what you're seeing where you are. Now, you're in Florida, which is a very controversial state coming up here in the next couple of weeks with the election. How is it sort of showing up in Florida with the people you're seeing?
Well, I think I'm not sure so much that I'm seeing it on the local level, but I'm seeing it more in the policy concerns. Well, first of all, you have the specter of vehicular cycling, which is very much headquartered in Florida and some other places as well. But I think Florida is really the center of the vehicular cycling movement. And I find that movement to be comprised largely of flat earthers. Vehicular cycling is a concept, at least taken in its totality, that doesn't make sense. It's wrong in principle, it's wrong in application, and it's not scalable. And it sends a very, very strange message to particularly new cyclists and to law enforcement about what the rights are of cyclists to the road. We can tackle the vehicular cycling thing, and I also think that has taken a political underpinning as well.
Define it. Define vehicular cycling.
Vehicular cycling is a movement that historically well, John Forrester wrote the book Effective Cycling, which is very much the beginning of the vehicular cycling movement in the 70s. And it definitely has usefulness. And it, as a concept, it is helpful, bike safety, but it has been overcome by infrastructure-based cycling. And there are people that are dead set against infrastructure and very much in favor of driving a bicycle like a car in car lanes. And it is a concept that is, while useful to some cyclists some of the time, is not for most cyclists most of the time.
I would totally agree with that.
And it's very controversial. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it is very controversial, and it's okay. I'm speaking with Peter Wilborn from Bike Law, and as many of you know, as you should know, I need to add this disclaimer. Bike Law is the sponsor for the Outspoken Cyclist. But I also go to them for really up-to-date information about the kinds of things we're talking about. And so I want to get back to this vehicular cycling. I do know about it now that you – for some reason, that was never the term I used for it. I know exactly what you're talking about. And it seems that that perspective is going to deter a lot of people who might otherwise get on a bicycle and recreate, go somewhere, and who need infrastructure. They will not ride in the street.
Absolutely. I think the future of the American cycling movement is infrastructure-based, no doubt about it in my mind. It's all about infrastructure. We are much safer the more people that ride the bike. Our jobs as bike advocates should be to encourage the most people to ride bikes the most places, the most times they can. That is the goal. It is not to service or help one subgroup of the cycling world. Yes, there is cycling that is better in the road, no doubt about it. There are cyclists at certain speeds that are better in the car lane of travel. There's no doubt about it. However, that is not the cycling movement writ large. The cycling movement includes children to disabled people to elderly people to new cyclists. Obviously, a new cyclist or a young cyclist is not safest in a car lane where the speed limit is 55 miles an hour or 45 miles an hour, quote unquote, taking the lane, right? I mean, that's absurd. And yet it is being pushed upon many people, particularly in social media, as the safest way to ride a bike. And it's just simply not true. Just simply not true. And I don't mean to equate it necessarily with politics. However, I believe some of the posts and the biggest proponents of vehicular cycling do follow a particular political bent.
Very interesting. And I think we'll refrain from getting into that for the time being, but I think it becomes fairly obvious if you just go out to social media and take a look around.
Well, absolutely right. I think if you look at some of those pages, frankly, the pages look like Russian troll pages. I believe I'm not being facetious.
Okay.
I believe the cycling movement is being seen as a progressive cause generally, right? And I believe there's a lot of discord within the cycling community, and I'm not certain that some of that discord is coming from places of good faith. I believe there are players in the bike conversation that are there for the purpose of trolling, for the purpose of creating controversy. We see that type of trolling in every other social cause movement. Why wouldn't we see it in cycling as well? And I have not seen other commentators really focusing on this, but my observation is a lot of the discord and controversy about safe cycling is trolling. It's not based in good faith. It's very, very few people that, for whatever reason, are throwing a monkey wrench into the problem. In other words, they're objecting to infrastructure. I mean, who the hell would object to bike infrastructure? Who the hell would say to children that they should be riding a bike in traffic if their desire was not to create problems? And I think that is a part of the social media landscape in the cycling conversation, for sure.
Wow.
It's not just a conceptual problem, because it is creating confusion among new cyclists. I have seen so many new cyclists, including clients of mine, scream, take the lane, without quite understanding what they mean when they say that. Taking the lane is an important thing to be able to do, but in very specific locations for very specific reasons. You don't just take the lane willy-nilly. That is not safe.
How does this include, and maybe it doesn't, but I think it does, diversity and equity and some of the things, the other things we're talking about, of people who need to ride a bike and who want to ride a bike?
It's such a great question, because at the end of the day, I will repeat what I said earlier. All we want is more people to ride more places more of the time. That should be our mantra. Everything that we do as bike advocates, as bike safety advocates, should be to get more people in the saddle, more people pedaling, more places, more of the time. Not certain people, not certain destinations, not certain recreations. Our job should be to get more people on bikes. Why? For a variety of reasons. But more people on bikes is the greatest predictor of cycling safety, without question. Places where there's a greater percentage of rideshare, when there's a greater percentage of people riding a bicycle, it is safer for the people that ride a bike. Anything that discourages ridership, that makes ridership more rare, is going to have the impact of making it less safe, less fun, less available. So to have diversity in cycling, it's really about being inclusive. How are you inclusive? You create infrastructure. You make bicycling an easy thing to do, right? If you look at why people ride a bike in Denmark, when they've polled them, they've asked them a million questions. Is it more fun? Is it because you want to lose weight? Is it because you love to ride a bike? Those aren't the reasons. People ride a bike because it's easier, right? It's easier to ride a bike in Copenhagen than it is to drive a car. That is the number one reason why people ride a bike in Amsterdam and Copenhagen. It is easier. And if you create infrastructure, if you create the ability to get more places by bike, more people are going to ride a bike. There's a huge pent-up demand, and that's what the COVID bike boom showed us. But the answer to that, the answer to inclusion and diversity, is not a policy question, a political question. It's really about creating safe places to ride a bike.
While I'm watching bike lanes being striped, which is one way, sharrows, which I really don't like very well, I'm also seeing a lot of new real infrastructure at least being planned. I'm not yet seeing a lot of it implemented, at least here in Northeast Ohio, but I think it's going to happen.
It absolutely is going to happen. It is. And let me talk about sharrows real quick. Sharrows are not a replacement for real infrastructure, but sharrows have a different function. Sharrows tell people which direction to ride a bike, right? I mean, if only that, sharrows are helpful. Because one of the big concerns for new riders is people ride against traffic.
Right.
And I want to address that. People don't ride against traffic because they have a death wish, and people don't ride against traffic because they want to give a middle finger to drivers and law enforcement. They do it because that's where they think they're safest. The last time there was comprehensive bike education in the United States, when people learned in kindergarten or elementary school, was in the early 70s, and people were told to ride a bike against traffic. And pedestrians, of course, walk against traffic. That's the law. So it stands to reason that people would think that is safer for them. They think they can see the oncoming issues. Obviously, they can't see traffic signals, and people coming out of intersections and driveways aren't looking for them. So driving, riding a bike with traffic is absolutely crucial to bike safety. And sharrows help show people which direction to ride.
Very interesting. Somehow it never occurred to me, but I do see exactly what you're saying. And of course, people who are riding against traffic are endangering themselves and drivers, by the way. They're
endangering everybody, but the point is they're not villains. They're not doing
No, they are not.
Right? They're just doing the best they can. And look, I think the answer to a lot of these questions is low-hanging fruit. Biking is not particularly complicated, and I think the answers to safe bicycling is not particularly complicated. Create infrastructure. People ride a bike. And you cannot buy a kid's bicycle in this country without getting on a waiting list. That's a good sign. People want to ride. We need to make sure that our primary focus as bike advocates is creating safe spaces for them to do so.
Let me ask you one more question before I let you go, because I know you have an amazingly busy schedule. It's been a challenging year in a lot of ways. Fewer people seem to be driving, although that seems to be changing. More people are riding. How has it changed the ratio of crashes between vehicles and bicycles?
You know, I don't know, because my information is only anecdotal, but our phone's ringing off the hook. And obviously, with more people riding, more people are getting into crashes. As far as the ratio, I believe the more people ride, it's safer for everybody else. But still, the gross number is still going to go up, right? The more people that ride, the more crashes there are going to be. I do want to touch on this political issue real quick.
Yep.
And here's what I'd like to say about it. I think it's very difficult to be a moderate these days. And I think being in the middle of some of these issues is exactly the right place to be. And it takes enormous courage, not cowardice, to stake out a place in the middle. And there are examples of this. A great example is the debate over law enforcement right now.
Right.
I believe that one can be, and I am, a proponent of Black Lives Matter. I say that sentence with absolute, from the chest, with tons of pride. Black Lives Matter, period. There are significant issues with racial bias and discrimination and harassment by law enforcement to people of color. There have been for a long time, and it's a really positive American development that we're actually having a very real conversation about that, period. However, that does not mean that enforcement of bike safety laws is a bad thing. And there is a lot of controversy brewing right now where progressive bike advocates are saying, because there are issues with racial discrimination in law enforcement, we therefore cannot promote in good faith enforcement of 3-foot passing law or harassment against cycling laws without asking law enforcement to get more involved and therefore giving them more opportunities to discriminate. That is a logical leap that I think is unsubstantiated. I do not think it is correct, and I think it ultimately is going to be very damaging to the bike advocacy community. We want 3-foot passing laws. We want more enforcement of bike safety legislation. We at Bike Law have done an enormous amount of training over the years of law enforcement. Lots of other people have as well. We want to teach law enforcement about bike laws. There is a drive that's happening to say, no, we don't want that. We don't want the police to be involved in enforcing anything. And again, I think that's a real mistake. And I think that it's gone too far. I think we can have a conversation about fair and equitable policing, but we need to do that by building bridges with law enforcement, training law enforcement, working with them, and in fact, relying upon them to keep us safer on bikes. And I think you should stay tuned to this question, because I think if the bike advocacy community goes against enforcement, in other words, severs its relationship with law enforcement and decides not to pursue legislation on a state-by-state level, like the 3-foot passing legislation, that requires enforcement to make a difference, then I think we're doing something that is ultimately going to set us all back and make cycling less safe.
Now I understand what the conversation, where it was going to go. And this was what you were talking about at the very beginning when I asked you about the intersection of advocacy and politics. It is political in its own way, this idea that we need to defund the police or get rid of enforcement. Or, you know, the minute somebody is in trouble, they dial 911. 911 brings you the police. So if they're not there to help you, they're not really all there to hurt you. It's a very small percentage, and they just seem to be highlighted.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And let's look at stop sign laws. Is anyone seriously saying that we should get rid of laws and enforcement for stop signs? Why is it that we're supposed to not rely upon enforcement for bike safety? It's because the movement is being seen as a progressive movement with progressive cause issues. And I'm not just pointing the finger at the left, because I'm also pointing a finger at the right. When you talk about Black Lives Matter and its impact on the cycling community, you have lots of right-wing cyclists that are rejecting the very idea that there's a problem to begin with. And that's filtering into conversations about bicycling. And I think that we should really understand that most people are in the middle on these issues. And again, it's not cowardice to say, you know what, I understand that there are issues of enforcement that we need to consider very seriously. On the other hand, we should not go so far as to sever our relationships that we've built over many years and decades even with law enforcement working on bicycle safety legislation that keeps us all safe. Because ultimately, our goal is what? It's to have a big tent community in which all are welcome on a bike. Riding a bike, as Rachel says, is this, Rachel at Bike Law, is the safest, the fastest way to save the world, the fastest way to save the world. And we want to do that with everybody involved. The growth in the future of cycling is about women. There's no doubt about that. We've done a lot of work promoting Women's Cycling Day and a lot of profiles and features of great, you know, women on bikes and really inspirational stories. We believe the future of cycling is a much more diverse group of people, a more diverse community. Everybody's welcome. But the only way that's going to occur is if we put safety first, right? And to put safety first, we have to have enforcement, law enforcement, as part of that solution.
Rules are rules. And to say there are no rules is chaotic.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. So again, I think that what I'm trying to say is that most of us are in the middle. And we, you know, where is the voice for people in the middle? Where are the people that want to engage in these conversations, but don't want to engage in name calling, do not want to virtue signal, do not want to identify the opponents as villains and saying, well, they're just fascist or they're just communist? That's all nonsense. Most people just want to ride a bike safely and want to have fun doing so. And unfortunately, the conversation, the future of doing that is being corrupted by politics. Well, let's just forget about that as cyclists. We all want each other to be able to ride a bike safely and happily. Let's do whatever we can to add more people to our Peloton.
Wow. On that note, I think we're going to call it a day. I really appreciate you taking time. I know you guys are slamming busy. We've been speaking with Peter Wilborn. He is the founding partner of Bike Law. Bike Law sponsors the Outspoken Cyclist, and he always has wonderful things to say. I hope you guys are safe. I hope you guys are well. And I can't wait to talk with you again, because every time I do, I learn something new, and it's really exciting stuff.
Diane, we're so happy for your success. We love the podcast, and keep doing the great work you're doing.
Say hi to Rachel. Have a great day.
Bye, Diane.
Bye. I am always energized and enlightened when I speak with Peter. If you are interested or ever need assistance with any legal questions or issues pertaining to cycling, you can log on to bikelaw.com. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, you'll meet Professor Chris Cherry from the University of Tennessee. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Welcome back. I'm Diane Jenkson. This is The Outspoken Cyclist. When his wife crashed at a railroad crossing on her way to work, and the head of his department at the University of Tennessee asked Chris Cherry what he was going to do about all the crashes that seemed to be occurring at this crossing near the campus, he and his team decided they'd better get to work and do something. The solution? His jug handle design. It was efficient, simple, and inexpensive. Dr. Chris Cherry is a professor in civil and environmental engineering whose primary research areas focus on transportation system impacts from energy technologies like e-bikes, e-scooters, and shared mobility on safety, sustainability, health, and mobility, and he joins us today. Hello, Chris Cherry. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to talk about a new study you just published, and it looks like a really great solution to a really dangerous problem for cyclists. We all know that railroad crossings can be literally deadly, but I do want to talk a little bit about how you came to this particular study. Tell us a little bit about your background, you know, what you do at the University of Tennessee, and what your major interests are around cycling especially.
Yeah, my name is Chris Cherry, as you know, and I'm a professor in civil and environmental engineering at the University of Tennessee. Focus on transportation, and I focus on design, safety, sustainability, And a big part of my focus is new disruptive technologies. And sadly or not, you might say bicycling has kind of been disruptive lately. A lot of cities are trying to figure out how to handle this surge of cycling. And that's a good thing, I think. The problem is infrastructure has a hard time keeping up. And one of the things I hope to do is identify ways to introduce new approaches to building good infrastructure for micromobility, for bicyclists, for all of these road users that are generally low impact road users.
Well, it's interesting that you have several projects going on right now at the same time. The one that was brought to my attention was specifically about these railroad crossings and something that you call a jug handle design. So explain, first of all, what that means and what you've done to sort of mitigate the problem that we all run into when we come to a railroad crossing.
Yeah, so every bicyclist who goes out there knows that or experiences, let's say, that when they go across a rail, there's these gaps between the rail and the pavement, essentially. And your tire can fall into that gap if you don't cross at some high degree angle. Now, that's kind of well known, but when it comes down to it, when you're out in the enjoying your bike ride, sometimes it doesn't register, or people think they hit the angle at the right in the right direction or whatever, and their wheel gets sucked into that gap and they end up oftentimes crashing pretty dramatically, pretty hard. And the design guidance is pretty vague. It says, okay, you need to build your roadways to approach these at 90 degree angles, which is, of course, impossible in a lot of urban environments. Or you need to swing your bike lane around or bike facility to where it crosses at something close to a 90-degree angle. And this is good general common sense, but it's impossible in a lot of areas. So our intention was to measure what people cross at and if and when they crash, what angles they crash at. And what we found was that basically over 30 degrees, the crash rate was very minimal. Over 60 degrees, it was non-existent. So what this means is that designers, engineers should do everything they can to bring these approaches to anything over 30 degrees, really. And that would reduce crashes. And it takes away some of the shackles of design guidance that says, if I don't reach this unattainable threshold, I might get sued or I might have some problems. And what ultimately happens in civil engineering design is if you can't meet something that is perceived as a standard, then you don't do anything. And that's really what happened in Knoxville for a while until the problem with this crossing became so apparent.
So there was a specific crossing that you began looking at first?
Yeah, so the research followed the problem. There was a notorious problem with a rail crossing, and every bicyclist knew about it, basically. And the story, the sort of inspiration, was my own wife crashed at this crossing on the way to a UT football game one time. And she knew all about crossing at right angles. And still, you know, the mechanics, the process of crossing, you don't always hit the angle right, and even when you know about it. So I said, oh, it's terrible. I wish they would fix this, but they wouldn't fix it because the guidance said you need to approach at a 90-degree angle or at least a 60-degree angle. And so it was never fixed, essentially. A little while later, my department head noticed somebody getting hauled off on an ambulance on the same crossing, you know, a couple weeks later, and asked me why I wasn't doing anything about it. I told him, you know, I'm going up for tenure and funding and all of the things that you think about. And finally, his thing to me that really hammered it home is, so somebody may have a head injury now because you don't have time or funding to investigate this problem.
Right.
I said, ah, yeah, okay, all right, fine. So I said, I'll make you a deal. I'll set up a camera in your nice corner office window overlooking the river and the rail and everything else. And we'll monitor it and see how big of a problem it is. And then within the first weekend, three cyclists crashed at that crossing. And nobody really knew the extent of this. None of these are ending up in police crash records or anything else, like any single bicycle crash. So then we knew we had an issue. I called the city. I said, they'd sort of had plans to work on it, but then this really triggered them to go full speed ahead and fix the problem. It's complicated. There's rail right-of-way is complicated in the U.S. DOTs, rails. In our case, we had a river nearby, so you had Army Corps of Engineers, the Tennessee Valley Authority. So think of all the institutions that kind of create challenges and bureaucracies around a simple project like this. So fast forward a few months and the city ended up fixing the crossing for just a few $1,000 in materials in-house, essentially. Whereas the prior design was going to be about the hundreds of thousands of dollars, essentially would basically wipe out the entire bike budget for Knoxville to fix this thing. So our engineers were innovative. They solved the problem. They used a design that probably didn't quite reach the design standard, but in the end, what they did is they fixed the problem. And as a result, we measured 50 crashes in 2 months, almost a crash a day on average. Extend that over the last few years, you can think of the dozens and dozens of cyclists that aren't injured today because of that.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Cherry. He is with the University of Tennessee. He's done this really cool design called the jug handle design, and you can actually see this. We'll put a link up to it on our Facebook page. So you answered some of my questions about who do you have to go to get these kinds of things changed. So is it the city? Is it the railroad? Is it the state? Is it the Department of Transportation? How did one start on this? And was this strictly a bike lane, or was this a street that also had to cross? And that, sometimes you're on a road and it needs to cross a railroad.
Yeah, so that's a good question. Part of this design was actually triggered from basic design issues. Essentially, upstream from this, up road from this, you might say, it's a really complicated intersection and there's a greenway, so a bike path, a separated bike path, and this shoulder is an extension of that. And then on the other side is a separated bike path. So on the other side of the road, you have a separated bike path that's very all ages and abilities friendly. Kids ride there and the whole deal. And on the shoulder side, you get more people that kind of want to get from point A to point B as fast and direct as they can, including myself. I ride over this thing every single day to work. The point being, I guess, is on the shoulder side, you're essentially blindsided by this rail crossing. You're coming along, and then there it is. It's a 10-degree angle, which is really a tight angle. And in order to make the maneuver, you have to kind of squeeze your bike through a little S turn within the shoulder of the roadway. And that's really what caused a lot of the challenges. Meanwhile, you have 45-mile-per-hour cars right next to you, so you hear them coming from behind, and you want to. So it's really harrowing to watch these videos as they were happening. And like I mentioned, the complication was we had a rail company, we had Tennessee DOT, and others who were all kind of in the mix. And it's really the rail company who is the unsung hero of this. It's a local rail company, and the city met with them and said, this is a problem. I met with the executives there. There was a little bit of we shouldn't have bicyclists going across a rail then, But then the other side was rails rule essentially in the United States in terms of right of way. If we can do everything within the right of way of the rail system, we don't have to engage with everybody else. And that's what the city ended up doing, as they said, if we can squeeze our entire design into this very narrow strip of rail right of way, then we can ignore all the other agencies that have some jurisdiction over that space.
Hmm.
And so that's what ended up happening. And in other urban contexts, it's, you know, transit lines and other things, light rail and streetcar lines, which is less complicated than freight rail lines or short lines. So
very interesting. The design is called a jug handle. So just think about what's on the side of your mm-hmm. coffee cup. And that's sort of the way it worked.
That's right.
We've been speaking with Dr. Chris Cherry. And how can people find out about that particular project?
First of all, if you just type skewed rail crossing in YouTube in Knoxville, you'll come up with some video of it's the kind of if you don't mind watching bicyclists crash, you can see what it was before. And if you want to read the short little paper, which is really accessible for anyone, you can search it on, just search jug handle crossing for bicycles and it'll pop up. The key is, I think, that it's even what we might call a substandard design has really high compliance and really, really effective, really low cost, solution to a known problem. And there's really no excuse not to build these everywhere. And it's a common approach to creating these sort of more angled approaches to bicycle infrastructure and rails.
All right, we're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, I want to know about two other projects you're doing. One is your COVID-19 impact study and your ME-bike studies. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On The Outspoken Cyclist. And if you're just joining me, I am speaking with Professor Chris Cherry. He's at the University of Tennessee. And in the first part of our conversation, we talked about a really interesting and relatively inexpensive solution for cyclists who have come across a railroad crossing and understand that how you need to cross it is not always the way the road works for you, and down you go. So now, I want to talk about two more of your projects. One is your COVID-19 impact project, and I think it's between Tennessee and Portland. Is that correct?
That's right. Nashville and Portland.
Yeah. Oh, Nashville. Okay. So tell us about that, because, of course, COVID-19, we'd have to mention it somewhere in our conversation, right?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah. So that project's really looking at transit systems and us other micromobility systems. And the idea is, what are barriers to riding transit in a COVID-19 world, in an era, and whether there's any chance for kind of a resilient, redundant system that includes micromobility, which could be bike share or scooter sharing. So shared micromobility, I'll say. Didn't really dive into personal bicycle use, which I think your listeners probably understand has been going up quite a bit as well. The main takeaway so far, and we're in the middle of it, is we're doing the surveys of transit riders and micromobility riders in Nashville and in Portland, and we're trying to understand their perception of COVID-19, what kind of behaviors they're adopting within COVID-19, whether they're taking transit and why not, and really looking at things like job status. Here I am sitting at home, working from home today. I wouldn't have taken transit. And perception, fear, risk, other things that could inhibit them using transit. And then what are they doing in place of that? And most of the people are either sitting at home, and if they're not, they're taking cars, basically. A few people are bicycling. Not very many people are using micromobility. That was one of our big questions. And to get back to transit, they need vaccines. That's basically fundamental, that we ask them these qualitative questions at the end, and they keep saying, we'll get back to transit when we get a vaccine. So it's a real dire situation for transit agencies in the U.S. We're continuing to see how perceptions are changing over the pandemic. We're hoping to be done by now with this research, but we keep doing surveys because we're still deep into it. So,
wow. I see the buses here in Cleveland and, you know, you must wear a mask, but I'm not seeing a lot of ridership. And I would not say it was our major form of transportation. We're a really car-centric city, which doesn't make me happy, but those are the facts. So Let's talk a little bit about your other study, your e-bike study, because we talk about e-bikes a lot on the show. What is that study about?
So that study, that's my main interest, actually, kind of my claim to fame, I guess, is e-bikes. And what I've done related to e-bikes in the past is really trying to understand why people ride e-bikes, what their purpose of using them are. Are they sustainable? Do they provide physical activity health benefits? And I've done research along those lines for years. And one of the things, now all your listeners know. So,
and I know.
So, yeah. So one of the things that has really been a limitation of e-bike research in the past is, and I'll criticize my own studies here, is when you do a survey of an e-bike user, you'll say, okay, you went from home to work typically this way by e-bike. What on a typical day, what is your typical mode substitution? Like, would you take a car? Would you take the bus? Would you take a bicycle? And the answer to that question is really relevant and important to all the other things I just said, safety, physical activity and health, and so on. This study aims to actually measure through a bunch of whiz-bang machine learning and artificial intelligence and all those other things. It aims to measure how much you take trips, not on a typical day, but on every day. So we're using an app to track e-bike users' trips. We're working with Bosch, who has the drive system for several OEMs, and we have a little Bluetooth connector, and then that connects with your phone, and that calculates sort of how many miles traveled that you're replacing by other modes. And then if you use Strava, it's like Strava except all in the background. Essentially, we're trying to guess without asking you every time, you started at this location and ended at this location every day. That must be your work trip, right? And the like. So that's the gist of that study. And we're trying to follow people over a year, follow them through the thick and thin of weather and daylight and everything else. And now COVID, of course, hit. Might as well talk about that again. That threw everybody's travel behavior into a tailspin. And so we're measuring that as well, unintentionally or unanticipated.
Are you using the Strava Metro, or are you feeding that information back to Strava?
No, we're not. The process is similar to Strava. If you use Strava, you know, you push, in that case, you have to push start, you get going, you push stop, and it records your trip. Ours is a little bit different because anybody who uses Strava knows they probably sometimes forget to push start or sometimes forget to push stop. And we've tried that in the past with our own in-house apps. The problem with Strava, of course, from a researcher perspective, is nobody can get that data.
Yeah, right. It's not your data.
It's kind of a raw form. It's not our data.
Sure.
So this one, we have research subjects. They know they're giving us data. And our app communicates enough with the bike itself, thank goodness they're e-bikes, let's say, that it does all of the starting and stopping on its own.
How many e-bikes are using this? I mean, how many people are in your study?
Yeah, so the plan was 200. The practice so far is about 50. So we're ramping up. Actually, right now, we're starting a big re-recruiting phase. We're slowed down because of COVID. We thought COVID would maybe blow over. We were hoping it would. Everybody's hoping it would, but it didn't. So now we're accepting the fact that our study is going to be influenced by COVID throughout. And so we're trying to add about 150 new users. If any of your listeners are Bosch riding e-bike riders, they can, again, Google e-bike, that is mobility by e-bike. And our website is hosted by Portland State University. So you can go pdx.edu or something like that, and it'll come up. That'll give you the information. And if you want to enroll and be part of it, then you can.
I have a question that has nothing to do with anything I prepared you to talk about because you had of this stuff ahead of time. And that is, first of all, I did not know you were that interested in e-bikes. And we've been talking a lot about e-bikes in the last year. I worked with Sea Otter and talked to Bosch about their system. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you're seeing as the future, looking into your crystal ball, as one person, I think, actually, Rob DeMartini from USA Cycling last week said into his crack crystal ball, if you're seeing an increase in e-bike ridership for other than recreation, are people using them for transportation?
Yes. The answer unequivocally is yes. That's reflected in our surveys. That's reflected in our MeBike study right now. Kind of the beautiful part about e-bikes or about bicycling in general is, and it's a difficult part when it comes to actually doing the research, is that there's a big blurred line between fun and utility. And so, for example, when I rode my bike home from work last night, I had this wonderful sort of head-clearing experience, got my exercise in, and got where I needed to go at the same time. So when we ask somebody, is it a recreational trip? We go, oh, well, it wasn't really. I did go from point A to point B, but I fulfilled these recreational needs that I had as well, or our exercise trip. And so the point being is if you're at Sea Otter, you're seeing the mountain bikes and all these other things. And that's a big growth area for the industry. So they're really leaning into that. But there's a huge cohort of e-bike users that are using them as transportation modes.
Are you seeing a specific age group?
The first adopters, the first wave were older people and people that they generally are have more money, have more income rather, and typical demographics, white, males, females are coming on board. And so that was the first wave kind of folks who wanted to continue bicycling, but maybe didn't have the physical strength or endurance to keep on. But more and more, they're becoming utility vehicles for city dwellers. And these include parents who are schlepping kids around town or around to schools or whatever other activity they have. I can relate to that. And other sorts of kind of urban utility machines, basically. As congestion, price, cost of living, cost of everything changes, e-bikes look pretty attractive in that regard, especially as cities have built out a lot of bike infrastructure in the last decade.
Are any bike shares looking at adding e-bikes?
Yeah. So actually, funny you should ask. We launched the nation's first e-bike sharing pilot test here at University of Tennessee way back in 2012.
Huh.
We actually integrated e-bikes into a two-station 20-bike system, and that was kind of some of the first research in the U.S. about how people used e-bikes on a kind of day-to-day basis, and that was the work of me and my students, essentially. Since then, the main e-bike bike share companies have launched e-bikes, and they're seeing that e-bike use is much higher than their conventional bike use. There's several companies that focus on this. For example, Portland's Bike Town just last month, I guess it was, converted all of their bike share system into e-bikes. Some of the purists might scoff at that, but in terms of an urban get-around-town vehicle, sometimes you just don't want to get your workout when you're going to a business meeting or going to lunch or going to pick up your kids. So.
I like that. Cargo bikes are another area where I see e-bike, or the assistance of pedal assist helping.
Yeah, so that's a big area. If you want to, there's some people looking at that, and that's something that we've explored in our survey. And we did a big survey in 2017. Is this idea of cargo bikes as a big growth area in terms of its niche, but it's growing.
Well, this has all just been fascinating. I'm really glad I figured out who you were. And my thanks to Dr. Tab Combs, who has been on the show in the past. She's the one who connected us. We've been speaking with Dr. Chris Cherry. He is at the University of Tennessee. We will post all of this information. He has his own website, by the way, and it's really simple. It is
chrisrcherry.com.
chrisrcherry.com. And it's got all of these studies. It's really fascinating. You've done a lot of really interesting work, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You have a great one. Stay safe.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Professor Chris Cherry joined me from his home in Knoxville, Tennessee. If you would like to watch the video of what the intersection looked like before the jug handle solution, you can find it on YouTube at Single Bike Crashes at Skewed Intersection. It's not pretty. And if you're interested in the solution, go to www.sciencedirect.com and search "A jug handle design will virtually eliminate single bicycle crashes at a railway crossing." So let's take another short break, and when we return, we'll catch up with Bike Cleveland's Jacob Van Sickle. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and this is The Outspoken Cyclist. Bike Cleveland, our local advocacy organization, has been busy trying to navigate the new normal of COVID for local cyclists. Jacob Van Sickle, the executive director, fills us in on some of the programs and projects in the works for the remainder of 2020 and on into 2021. Hello, Jacob. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. How's Bike Cleveland?
It's going well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Of course, I'm always happy to talk with you. Been a tough year. How's Bike Cleveland's all of the events that you had plans for the season?
Yeah, it has. It has been a tough year for a lot of in-person things. We ended up taking a lot of our activities virtual or at least online. We did cancel some of our bigger events like the Fundo, out of a need for caution and safety, but we were able to kind of pivot and create a lot of really great online content to help kind of nurture people that are already biking, but also help support those folks that are kind of getting into biking because of kind of the coronavirus issues. We created some kind of solo virtual tours of Cleveland and surrounding neighborhoods. We took all of our Bike Smarts, which are education classes, online and share them online with folks as well with a recording. Just trying to find any way we can, continue to support the cycling community.
So have you seen a big increase in the number of people riding?
Yeah, anecdotally, we have. A lot more people out riding, for physical fitness, for mental health, especially in the beginning times of some of the lockdowns, being cooped in the house all the time wasn't very good for your mental health. So, being able to get out on a bike was a great way to do it. And one thing we did start, and a lot of communities across the country did, we started this program called Bike Match, where we were trying to match up people with extra bikes just laying around the garage that were in working order with folks that needed a bike, during the pandemic, either for, essential travel or to visit loved ones or just to get some physical activity. And, as part of that, we were able to match 15 people up with bikes. But by far, the demand outweighed the inventory that we had. So we actually still have a list of about 130 people that are in need of bikes. So there definitely was interest out there.
Well, I hope the people listening might be able to dig some out, although we're seeing the same thing, in the bike shop and in the bike business, that people are digging bikes out of everywhere. And then we've run into the issue of not having parts, tires, tubes, cables. Yep. It's been a really strange year. So let's talk a little bit about these workshops that you're going to be putting on.
Yeah. So, in November, we have our Bike Smarts class that we're hosting, and it's going to be focused around winter cycling. And then actually in the next week, October 27th, we're doing a Random Acts of Brightness, which is an opportunity for folks that are riding around at night that don't have lights to get a free bike light. And we're going to be doing those at Public Square, downtown Cleveland, as well as in
University Circle area of Cleveland as well.
Oh, well, when is that exactly, so that I can put it up on our site and let people know about it? I mean, this, you're listening to this on Saturday, the people who are listening.
Yeah, so it's October 27th from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. And some of the details are on our website at bikecleveland.org. So if you're riding around new to cycling and you don't have a bike light, it's an essential, especially if you're riding at night. So we want to be able to, talk with you a little bit about riding your bike safely, specifically at night, but also give you a bike light.
That's really cool. How were you able to get these lights?
Yeah, so these were lights we purchased just with some of our membership revenue dollars that we get, as a way to kind of, spread the love and support, people that are new to biking or people that can't necessarily afford a bike light but need to ride around at night to get to work or get to school or get to wherever they need to go.
Do you have other events coming up for winter? Well, it's not winter yet. It's still fall, technically.
Yeah, we do. Some of them are ones that we're kind of pivoting to be more COVID friendly. So the third Tuesday in November, we have our Bike Smarts class. It'll be virtual again on Zoom. And it's focused on winter cycling and how you can kind of be best prepared to ride your bike in cold temperatures. And then on November 21st, which is the Saturday before Thanksgiving, we're hosting our annual Cranksgiving event. If you've participated in the past, you'll know, it's really a bike ride food raiser for local hunger centers. And last year we raised about $3,500 in food for a local hunger center in Parma. This year we're modifying a little bit to try to spread people out, and we're hosting five different locations where people can ride to and grab a map of nearby grocery stores, do some grocery shopping, and then ride back, and then we'll drop the food off, and then we'll donate it to some local hunger centers in the area. And those will take place in Brecksville, Parma, Lakewood, up in the Heights areas, and then we'll host one in Cleveland.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Jacob Van Sickle. He is the executive director of Bike Cleveland. And if you don't know anything about it, and you are relatively new to cycling, and you're listening to this, you can find out about it at bikecleveland.org. So the last thing I want to talk about is 2021. What do you see coming for the Cleveland area, both in, maybe new infrastructure and in the possibility of us getting back out there in groups?
Yeah, so, for 2021, we're still, deciding, depending on how COVID's going and what that looks like on how we'll do some events, but we'll continue to try to, find ways to bring the cycling community together, either virtually or in person, if we can do it safely. Advocacy and infrastructure-wise, there's a lot of really great things happening that are kicking off the end of this year and into 2021. And the one I'm most excited about is the city of Cleveland is going to be kicking off a Vision Zero action planning process.
Ooh, so good.
If you're not familiar with Vision Zero is, it's a strategy to eliminate all traffic fatalities and serious injuries on the roadways. So this will be a year-long process, really community-focused, and coming up with strategies for how the city and community partners can all work together to eliminate all traffic fatalities and serious injuries in the city of Cleveland. And then kind of tied to that, we're also, continue to advocate for bike lanes on streets. And, some of the bike lanes we'll see started or complete in 2021 include, bike lanes on Miles Avenue on the southeast side of Cleveland and Union Avenue in connecting the Slavic Village neighborhood to Mount Pleasant, as well as, West 65th Street. And then some of the most exciting projects we'll see completed in 2021 include a lot of the Cleveland Metro Parks Tiger Grant projects that they applied for and received and have been under construction for a few years. But that includes things like the Red Line Greenway, a beautiful bridge over to Whiskey Island from the flats, as well as a Whiskey Island connector and a few other trails that'll all be complete in 2021. So we'll have some really great new infrastructure projects to go out and ride together, hopefully in 2021.
All sound really exciting. We've been speaking with Jacob Van Sickle. He is the executive director of Bike Cleveland. If you are interested in any of these projects, or if you want to join the organization, or if you want to join up on one of the virtual events that are going to be still happening this year because we can't ride together yet, log on to bikecleveland.org. Well, Jacob, thank you so much. Stay safe, stay healthy, have a great holiday season, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Diane. You too. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Take care.
You too. Bye.
My thanks to Jacob Dr. Chris Cherry, and to Peter Wilborn for joining me on the show this week. Please remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page, leave us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Here's a sneak peek at our show for next week. According to Strava, millions of people track their rides, runs, and walks to Strava every week with their phones or GPS devices. The Metro app strips this data set of identifiers and aggregates it. What is left is a vast source of trends and insights. And what Strava is hoping to do is the subject of the conversation I'm going to have with CEO Mark Ganey next week. We'll also be speaking with Josh Crisp. He is with the Pedal for Alzheimer's organization. Until then, I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps, and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.